In the category for podcast even Jesus would like, Lug Radio is the winner. Come on down, Jono, Stuart, Aid and Matthew, to your wonderful collection ceremony.
I've got a suggestion. Put the fucking sock back on the mic.
You sockless mic speaking idiot.
Welcome to the award-winning Lug Radio.
Indeed.
Season 4, episode 5.
Yeah, we won an award at the Linux Open Source User and What's It Award. We won Best Marketing Campaign for Lug Radio Live 2006.
And so that we would be?
Sorry?
Lug Radio.
We would be.
Yes. So,
which is made up of?
Oh, Matthew Revell.
I was trying to say the name. Okay, yeah, Matthew Revell.
Yep.
Hey, pressure.
Who are you?
I'm Stuart Langridge.
And I'm Jono Bacon. So, welcome to the show.
Yeah, welcome to the award-winning show.
The award-winning show.
I'm the award-winning Matthew Revell.
I'm the award-winning Jono Bacon.
We have a huge piece of glass, carved glass, with our name on it.
It's on the award-winning mantelpiece in the award-winning living room.
It is. So, hello from the four award winners to you, not award winners out there in the community.
Unless you're John Mad Dog Hall.
Yeah. Yeah, so peasants.
Does he listen to the show?
No, I don't know.
Probably not, no. I don't know if you can hear through the beard. Anyway.
Your ears aren't underneath your beard, you know.
His ears are underneath his beard.
Well deserved award for him as well.
Well deserved award for us. Yeah.
What's on the show? We're going to talk about hardware and the fact licensing. That we can't make hardware.
Licensing. We're going to talk about licensing.
Yep.
Indeed.
Interview Popey the pilot.
Popey the sailor man.
Popey
the sailor man.
About Lux. Communities, yeah.
Yep. And is there anything else we're due to talk about?
I'm sure there is.
Every fucking time.
Yep, so shall we begin the show in an appropriate fashion?
Yes, let's
walking, not running.
Let's do that.
The other week at Linux World, there was a discussion about licensing, specifically the GPL3.
That was very interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
to
be honest, licensing.
You guys have all the fun.
And I was going to go to Linux World, and I missed it.
It's not the most exciting and exhilarating of discussions.
But I went to watch Paint Dry Expo UK instead.
Well, you know, it's better than going to the Storage Expo, isn't it?
Storage Expo rocks. Bed.
Storage Expo rocks.
It does.
So anyway.
Yes.
GPO.
Version 3. So anyway, in this discussion, people were sort of saying finite points of the GPL3, like the DRM-related issues.
Finite points. No one made an infinite point. Although they'd still be doing it, wouldn't they?
Anyway, and and some of...
your point was...
The point was... the thing that struck me was there was a lot of discussion about specifics of licenses and all this kind of stuff, but we've got, let's say, 4 or 5 main licenses. We've got 300 licenses in total or whatever. And out of these 4 or 5 main licenses, there doesn't seem to be anybody who is working to make licensing easier, because a lot of people who have to license software are typically software developers, particularly in the free software world, where they're just geeks who want to hack on software and give it away now. And there needs to be something like maybe the OSI. need to make something to make this easier. And licensing is too fucking difficult. So
they should do something like the Creative Commons.
Like the Creative Commons thing. Yeah.
Mix and match.
You don't half talk a lot of shit at times.
Here we go again. That's how he grabs the audience again.
You see what I mean?
Wrong. All the time.
It's all lots of bollocks.
if you lot didn't talk so much shit, I wouldn't have to interrupt you, would I? Right? The reason it works for Creative Commons is because out of nowhere, they decided to invent 9 licenses or 12 or whatever they are. Whereas all these other licenses already exist. If you go back in time 20 years and say, wouldn't it be a good idea if we invented basically one open source-ish kind of license, which is sort of, you know, partitionable and breaking up into bits, then yeah, that probably would be a good idea. But you can't just go sweep away all previously existing licenses and invent a new set.
There's a third way, though.
Give me a B.
Matthew opens his third eye.
There is. There's a Tony Blair to it. And there's the situation where you don't have to sweep all that lays before you, but you kind of approach it from the other angle, which is that you've got all these licenses.
I've heard you like to approach things from a different angle.
Shush. You create a picker like the Creative Commons have got, and someone like the OSI could do that because it's their job, and they're the ones who say whether it's open source or not for some reason. So they can create a picker where you go along and it picks out of the five or so main licenses, do you want it to be redistributable so people can do whatever they want with it? Tick yes. Ah, have a BSD license.
Yeah, like basically the CC thing. And the thing is...
Licensepicker.com.
That's what we need.
It. Someone do that.
Version 2.0 with a gradient, bit of Ajax. Yeah.
Should say beta at the top.
Maybe there's a link cloud.
No, but in all seriousness, licensepicker.com would be awesome.
But the thing is...
What a great idea.
I'm surprised that...
I'm glad you had it.
I'm surprised that Ack has the view he's got, because we've had a lot of discussions in the past about... lots of things are really difficult to use and lots of things are overly difficult. And the way I see it is that software developers fundamentally know what they want, the kind of things they want to decide on with their software. Should it be free or should it be commercially available? Should attribution need to be placed towards it? Can it be used in certain general situations? And then what you should do is there should be something, someone should be able to say, well, this is the license that approximately satisfies what you want. If you want to know the nitty-gritty specifics, then you can go into the details.
Now, you see, the reason I don't think that's the case is that you're imagining that there are basically three or four questions you'd have to answer.
No, I'm not.
Do you think do you want your software to be able to be used in a commercial environment? Do you want your software to remain free even after redistribution? Do you mind if people take it proprietary? So you ask sort of four or five questions, and then you say, the license you want, you know, do you want to retain trademark rights?
We need Clippy for licensing. You see, the
problem is that the reason lots of different licenses exist are because there aren't three or four questions. There are 300 or 400.
Which
means that basically what you're implicitly saying is, yeah, the reason there are all these licenses, there fucking shouldn't be. There should be six.
But
because
that's the truth.
Should, yeah.
But why?
Why? Because most of these licenses, as I understand it, and with a very small amount of understanding, admittedly as it is that people come along and say, I don't want Mozilla Corporation to be able to do whatever they want with it. I want my corporation to be able to do what they want with it. So I'll
tiny little
the
differences,
MPL,
yeah,
and I'll call it the Jeff's public license. Isn't that the situation?
Because
I don't really understand. No, not really.
It's not just a case of saying what you're talking about is not the Mozilla public license, it's the Netscape public license,
by the way.
But...
yeah.
But the key point about it is, imagine you had Matt's license, right?
Yeah.
Which said, you can do anything you want with this software, but I'm allowed to take it to priority, but nobody else is.
As long as it's one-eighth your size.
Right. Okay. Now, that would be a non-free license, according to the FSF, but imagine you had it anyway.
Yeah.
Yes, I could then come along and make that Stuart's license and just cross out the word Matt and write Stuart on in blue felt tip pen. And that would be a different license. But that's not what people are doing.
They're trying to address
issues outside the other thing. So, I mean, take the Mozilla public license, for instance. It's got some stuff in it about patents and some stuff about trademarks that the GPL doesn't have.
So you're honestly sitting there and telling us that there aren't too many licenses?
No, I think there are way too many licenses.
Oh, okay,
I think 95% of the licenses that are out there that people say, look at all this license proliferation in open source software. There are 300 licenses. 290 of them are only used by the projects who thought them up.
Yeah, but the point is then that if you are going to be wanting to do that specific level of granularity and small changes, then you have to hire a lawyer. Tough shit.
But you've got a license, and that's what everybody's doing.
But this is the point I'm making, is that if you look at the whole spectrum of where people need to make a decision about licenses, I suspect with free software particularly, probably at least 60 or 70% of people will care about approximately the same sort of things. And that's the reason why the GPL is used so much. Now, there are going to be certain scenarios where people have got very specific reasons, and I'm not in any way suggesting that we should never ever heed the advice of a lawyer in certain situations. But I think most free software developers fundamentally care about whether this is going to be made available, what happens with redistribution, what happens with, you know, modifications, the core things that you expect in free software, many of which are outlined by the GPL.
What
the point I'm making is that is that you've got all of these very, very specific things, right? And I don't believe that most people need to make decisions about all of these specific things. They just want a general approximation of a free license.
I agree with you completely, but my policy on this, anytime anybody says, what license should I use for this, your answer should be the GNU GPL.
Right.
Don't say there's this one, or there's the BSD license, or the MIT license, or the X11 license, or the Mozilla Polo. Just say use the GPL for everything. Would you be happy with that?
It's not a one size fits all, though, is it?
No, but that's the point. As soon as you start saying,
for 95 or 98% of people, three or four licenses is enough.
Why are three or four licenses enough? Why isn't one license?
But hang on a second. The point. What I've just said is that a single license isn't going to satisfy everybody. But what I'm saying is that there's certain licenses satisfy a very large demographic of the free software world.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm saying we should make it easy to pick between those licenses. If your criteria is not satisfied by those licenses, then it should basically say, here's a big list of licenses you're going to have to figure out yourself. But that would satisfy most of the cases.
I agree with you. The problem with what you're saying is that the differences between them aren't relevant. If someone comes in, they know nothing about free software and open source, and they say, I read about this in a thing, and our company's got some stuff, and I'd like to get involved with this open source community. And then you go to a license picker thing, right? The differences between the half dozen common licenses are going to be fucking totally irrelevant to them.
Why? Because the vast majority of it is little itty bitty things, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Exactly. CDDL.
The difference between the GPL, the LGPL, the MIT license, the BSD license, and the Apache license and the Mozilla public license. Say we take those six, and that's what your license picker picks between. Right?
Yeah.
Your license, and then there's a public domain license, a completely proprietary license, and a go and look yourself option.
Yeah.
So there's nine options there. Yeah. Right? Of seven of those options, you'd have to sit down with someone and spend 25 minutes explaining the whole concept of software licensing before they even understood what the differences were.
But I'm fairly.
So why didn't license picker just say, use the GPL, whatever the hell they
do? Would you really? Wouldn't you just have to say, so for example, if they said, I want people to be able to do whatever the hell they want with it and show them the source code, but I want to retain ownership of the copyright, say, BSD license. If they say, I want it to be free software and make sure that if people make changes to it, then they have to publish it under the same license, you say GPL. Yeah. I mean, it's not perfect.
I believe that you could have a page with 10 questions that ask you about things to do with what you'd expect your software to be used. Redistribution, modifications, things like that. I believe you could have 10 questions, which isn't too much, and you could reasonably discern between those licenses to a fairly high degree of accuracy. And that's all it needs. I think anybody would be happy to answer 10 questions and then get a license that's right for them.
You are aware that if you've got 10 questions, they're just yes or no questions.
Sure. Yeah,
that's 1,024 possible answers.
Right.
No, it isn't. It is.
But what I'm going to say, what the fuck?
But it doesn't have to be, does it?
But the thing is, the point I'm making is that
the point is, why can't you cut it down to three questions?
The point is,
if you're suggesting that some of those 1,024 answers will be the same license,
right?
Then you shouldn't need as many questions.
No. Okay, no, the thing is that those 10. You're saying there's lots of minor differences between these licenses. That's the reason why I'm saying you should have 10 questions. I believe
that gives you 1,024 possible outcomes,
right? What do I care? The software figures it out for me.
You want 1,024 different licenses, do you? So your problem is not license proliferation, it's that people don't understand the difference between them.
What I'm saying is that
do you believe it would be fine if there were 1,024 different free software licenses, as long as it was clear to everyone which one they should pick?
No. Well, actually, you know, yes, I do. I think it's fine to have. I don't care how many licenses are out there, as long as people understand how to choose between them. The problem is that right now, I think there's a reasonably large proportion of free software developers think, I don't really care about licenses. I don't care about legal issues, but I know that the GPL basically works and other people use that.
My problem with having 1,024 licenses is that what we're trying to give people is freedom with free software, yeah?
Yeah.
And part of that freedom is empowerment, is knowing what rights you've got. And if you've got 1,024 different licenses, you won't know
completely
what you've got.
Yeah, the question is not just, I've written some software, what should I license it under? It's, I've got some software under a license, what does that mean?
Sure, but the thing is, if I could go to a web page, right?
Licensepicker.com.
Licensepicker.com, and I could fill in my 10 questions, right? And that would choose a license for me that's suitable. One of these 1,000 licenses.
I think 98% of people or 99% of people would be more than happy with that.
Possibly, but then imagine I could feed that license into licensepicker.com with an approximation. And it could give me a summary of my rights.
No one is going to do that.
I know, but the point I'm making is that not choosing between 1,000 licenses, I'm talking about choosing between the five big licenses.
That's not the point. Yeah, you're missing the point. No one is going to come up with a piece of software, you feed it a license, and it tells you what your legal rights are. Because at that point, they're a lawyer, and they're liable for the advice they
give. No, because the Creative Commons bit, although... Admittedly, was it Lessig was involved or Moglen? One or the other one.
I don't know. Probably Lessig because he's a CC bloke.
The Creative Commons thing will do it absolutely. But what you have to say at that point is if there is one letter different in what you feed me, I'm going to say I don't know about this license. Go away.
Can you not just put anal at the top?
It's always a suggestion, though. I don't think if they suggest these things and that you take a license that you. I'd be surprised if you have the right to sue them. It's an approximation.
I would not at all be surprised if you had the right to sue them.
The thing is,
if you put up a website which says put in a license and we'll tell you what your legal rights are under that license, you're a lawyer.
What your legal rights may be. No, what are your legal rights? Just this license.
That's legal advice.
Isn't.
Writing I am not a lawyer and then giving legal advice doesn't exonerate you from liability.
So, question, do you believe that, let's say these five, let's say maybe even 10 top licenses, most common licenses, do you believe that you couldn't discern between them with 10 questions?
I believe you could easily discern between them with 10 questions.
But you believe that's wrong because you should apply it to all of the licenses.
I think you could discern between them with about 3 questions.
Right. What would they be, just out of interest? I'm really interested to know because I don't understand.
I suspect the questions would be, do you want other people to be able to take your software proprietary? Do you want your software to remain free even if someone else changes it? They'd be 2, and that would give you 4 options.
So what do the CDDL do and all that stuff?
Let's not get into the specifics.
We don't get into the specifics.
But why not? Because they're important.
But we don't know.
We don't know enough about it.
I mean, most of the extra things are things like putting one particular organisation in a privileged position.
Yeah.
So they say, even if you take this software and it blows up, you can't sue us.
The thing is then, is if you believe it can happen in 10 or even less, there's no fucking reason why it shouldn't happen.
Good.
So,
license pick it up.
Let's see it happen. This could be another thing that Lug Radio
come on, Popey.
Did. Yeah. Okay, on the show right now, we've got Popey the Sailor Man. How are you doing?
Hello. Oh, God. You didn't call me.
Yes, we did.
Yes, we did. So this is Alan Pope, who's also known as Popey.
He's obviously an Elvis impersonator.
And also looks like Elvis, honestly.
I had a haircut to try and not look like Elvis.
Lies.
But it still happens everywhere.
Now it looks like Elvis in G.I. Blue, presumably.
Well, you're a great...
Well, left the barbers, if they say. Elvis has left the barbers.
Elvis has left the barbers. Anyway, we haven't even...
Trouble is, he keeps marrying 14-year-old German girls.
So, anyway.
Wasn't that Jerry Lee Lewis?
Let's keep on track. So, Alan Pope is... a strong contributor in terms of the Lug circuit in the UK. In the UK, we have a central system called lug.org.uk, and although Alan's not representative, he's not part of this entity. He's a strong contributor to his Lug and to a number of and contributes to other Lugs. So we're here to talk about that. So Popey, tell us, where do you see the Lug project right now, and what's good about it, what's bad about it?
Well, it's probably best to start with a brief history. Lugs in the UK started with Manchester in, I think, 94. They were the first Lug in the UK. And then there was one in West Yorkshire in 97, then Hampshire in 98. And Hampshire was the first one on the new lug.org.uk server that was set up by Mark Lewis and Ken Adams back in the day. And since then, it's grown to 150-odd mailing lists, websites, and there's a bunch of IRC channels. There's an IRC server in there as well. So that's from the technical side. What a lug is, a whole bunch of lugs provided, service provided by lug.org.uk. But then also there's the actual stuff the lugs do, which is hold meetings, whether it's in a pub or in a university or a hall or whatever it might be, or someone's house, and whatever they do. Some of them not quite as active as others. some of them are really, really busy, like Hans Lug. I'd say it's probably one of the busiest.
Yeah.
Actually, it is the busiest, I think. Well, it depends how you measure a lug, really, because you could measure a lug by how many people are subscribed to the mailing list.
Right.
But is that fair?
No.
No.
There might be 200 people signed up to the mailing list, but of those, only 100 of them ever even read the mail, and of those, only 10 of them actually reply.
Yeah. So,
or do you measure it by how many meetings they do, or...
So what would you say? I mean, some people would say that the lugs are, in some ways, some people, cynics, would say that lugs are a bit irrelevant and they're just small collections of geeks, and they're not for the normal person. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I saw someone say that just last night on IRC.
Right.
And it's tricky, really, because, the vast majority of lugs that I've seen and I go to, most people who are there are geeks, but at my local lug, we have people who turn up who are just turn up off the street and say, "Hey, I've got this problem with my computer. Can you guys fix it?"
Really?
Whether it's a Linux machine,
exactly.
or we've even had people turn up with Windows machines, and we grab
no way
Windows to a lug,
an Ubuntu CD, and sorting it. But it varies, and I can see why people might say lugs are irrelevant and lugs don't matter anymore, but it's not really fair, because it's a way for people like us to get together and talk about the issues of the day. I mean, if I take my own history, I don't have, unsurprising as it may seem, a wide social circle of friends outside of the open source community. Part of that is because I spend so much time with my friends within the open source community and the free software community.
So you're a hermit.
So I don't really have time for these people who, aren't really into the same things that I'm into.
Aha! If you're not into Linux, you are not my friend. Or ghost.
Yeah, pretty much.
so from what you're saying then, at least the way you see lugs, they're not really necessarily designed to reach out to people who aren't really interested. They're more kind of a club for people already interested in Linux to get together and talk about it.
I see a lot of people call them, computer clubs, but each lug is different. And as a representative, if you like, of lug.org.uk, we host 100+ lugs, and every single one of them is different, and they all do different things. And whilst one of them might be insanely technical and have, very geeky people who talk at ones and zeros all the time, others are, just a bunch of guys down the pub who, have a curry now and again, like Wolves Lug, for example. And it's, okay, you might talk technical while you're there, but it's more of a social meet that has a technical slant, whereas others are a technical meet that has a bit of a social slant. Maybe they go down the pub afterwards or...
Eat some curry.
Chat while they're there. And a lot of them are very computer club-like and not designed for getting open source out to the masses.
Yeah.
But that helps to get fixed by projects like InfoPoint.
You've got
people like Tony and Kat and Dave and Alan Cox. Not the Alan Cox, the other Alan Cox.
Alan Cox, isn't it?
As in
C-O-K-C-K. Oh, some combination of those letters. the Bracknell area. He goes out and regularly, he's an absolute Trojan, goes out and does info points, bringing Linux to the masses. And then you've got people like Nick Butler down in Sussex who does the same thing. So, you could see that people could argue that lugs aren't about getting Linux and open source out to the community, but then you have key people like that who are so driven to want to get stuff out to the community that actually it does happen.
So, Popey, give me some idea of two or three really, I suppose, innovative, exciting things that you've seen lugs do that help to promote the free software way.
Innovative and exciting things.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, come on.
Those two words aren't words I would put with lugs.
Bloody hell! We've got you on there too. To pimp it up, man. Come on.
No, seriously. I mean, lugs have been around for a long time. Okay, some of them are getting a bit stale, and they need a bit of invigoration. So right now, no. I'd say a lot of lugs aren't exciting and massively interesting. If someone comes along to a lug meet, if you sort of put yourself in the position of a complete stranger, complete newbie, and you walk into a lug meet, and you see a bunch of guys with their heads down at computers, and they're talking to each other on IRC in a lug meet.
That's just
I've
wrong.
I've seen that happen. And that's not innovative, and that's not exciting.
No, really? You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's been some discussion at, Linux World particularly.
And Lug Radio Live.
And Lug Radio
Live.
And at Lug Radio Live. That Well, you don't know what the discussion's been about. I haven't said it yet.
Well, there has been some
he
discussion.
Might have spies.
You haven't qualified.
Oh, there has been some discussion, yeah. I mean,
sort of generic.
I apologise. But yeah, there's been some discussion that you, Popey, the sailor man, are a bit of a king when it comes to the lugs, and you've got a lot of enthusiasm, and you're the man to make this happen. You're the man who should kind of reinvigorate the lug circuit, and you should be President Popey.
Lord of the lugs.
So,
yeah, I know where that's come from.
Right, yeah, this has come from Nick, predominantly. So, yeah, well, what do you say to that? I mean, come on, pull your finger out, stop whining, you're going to do it, right?
Okay, what I would say is, how many lugs, there's like 100 plus lugs, each one of them has a lug master.
Yeah,
Twisted Lug Master. They are entirely separate entities, they do what they like. It's entirely up to them whether they hold meetings, whether they go out and do info points or not. I absolutely can't, even as the person who helps pay for the hosting of the lug box and does a little bit of the admin, along with the other guys who do the vast majority of the admin, like Alistair Kurgan and Andy Smith,
yeah.
I don't actually do that much. Yeah, okay, I big it up now and again, and I'm a member of all the mailing lists, so I see a lot of the discussion that goes on UK lugs, but I'm not sure. I mean, you tell me, what do you think lugs need invigorating in? What could you go in and tell them to do? Ask them to do?
I'd say the thing is, it's not about invigorating specific lugs, but the lug.org.uk project needs leading. Like, the project itself, it seems to me that you've got lots of independent lugs. It's a bit, it's similar in some ways
but
to...
But lugs are so different.
It's similar in some ways to, one thing that Popey's involved in is he's involved in Ubuntu UK, which is a UK local team for Ubuntu. And the Loco project, there's lots of groups all over the world.
So what's that, company? Ubuntu?
Ubuntu, yeah, right. You might have heard of it, Aid.
To let you know, I am wearing my official Ubuntu polo shirt just so I fit in.
Woohoo!
Okay, go ahead.
But the thing is, the Loco project in some ways needed leading, and that's what I've tried to do. And that's, I mean, I haven't done a huge amount with the Loco project, but it's shown some benefits, and it seems like the lug.org.uk project needs someone to lead the project as a whole. So, kind of a top-down approach where suggesting, you know, things that lugs can do, organising events for the whole circuit of lugs and things like that.
Lugs
yeah, but
got,
you know,
organize
you know
themselves.
What organising people like this, who do this in their spare time, voluntarily, who... It is like herding cats. You know, you can't tell these people what to do. I spent, you know, a large portion of time... talking to people about what we should do to improve lug.org.uk services, and a lot of that's being done now. We're, you know, buying new hardware, we're implementing a new website, we're putting new services in place, we're separating out services so that you know, some dipstick who puts a PHP based forum on their lug doesn't screw the entire system for absolutely everyone, you know, that kind of stuff. And these are just sensible things, but I'm not sure that lug.org.uk should do much more than that. We are a technical service provider for the lugs. It's up to the lugs to actually do stuff. And some of them are autonomous, like Hans Lug, like Surrey. I mean, Surrey now have got their meetings happen at Red Hat's headquarters in Guildford, which is fantastic. That they've got, you know, great location with, you know, great people on tap. I'm sure they'll get, you know, loads of merchandise and CDs and have access to the right people, and that's brilliant. Whereas then you get other lugs where there's one mail per month, you know, saying our meeting will be next week, and like two people turn up.
But
what
I'd say, I mean,
those people?
Yeah, but to be fair, I mean, it's not about telling people what to do, is it? It's about
having
providing
opportunities. It's a champion. It's an advocate for the lug group. And much as you don't want to admit it, you're the man for the job. And so, what I'd like to do right now is to encourage everyone in the UK who's listening to this to put posters up around the UK saying, "Vote President Pope." President Pope's the man for the job. So,
black smoke,
I'll leave the country.
So you know, would you consider it if people really wanted it to happen?
Well, it depends what the role is. I mean, you know, if the role is someone who helps herd cats in the Linux community in the UK, then that's pretty much it. Then, yeah, fine.
No, I think it's not to do with herding cats myself. I think it's more to do with just being... You know, all of us need a bit of a kick up the arse, and not necessarily going around and saying, "Hey, Dave Morley, do a better job on Wolf's Lug." I'm not saying he needs
bad
to.
Bad example.
But, you know, what I'm saying, because he's doing a good job, he's just taken over.
Yeah.
But he's the first lug master I could think of. What I'm saying is that sometimes we just need someone who's like really showed a bit of enthusiasm, and then that's infectious. And you know, you with your Elvis looking ways, you're an infectious kind of guy.
Yeah, but you can't be everywhere.
No,
you know,
true.
You can't. Where do you start? I mean, what do? Do you go to? I mean, our local. Take for example. I'll finish a sentence in a minute. I really will, honestly. take for example my local lug. We were having meetings every month, and one little thing that I did. I don't do much for my local lug. One little thing that I did was I happened to be at work in California. I went to Silicon Valley's lug. And there was just a couple of little things I picked up from that, which was when people turn up to their meetings in Silicon Valley Lug, you get given a badge. And part of that was because you were on corporate premises at the time. Their meetings were at the Cisco building, so you had to wear a badge so people knew who you were and why you were there. And I thought, this is great. People can wear badges so that other people can see who they are. And they've got some reason to walk up to them and say, oh, you're John, I met you on the mailing list. You know, you replied to my mail, can you have a look at my PC? Or, you know, just go over and shoot the breeze and stuff like that. Yeah. Brought that back to Hanslug. We've now got a web-based badge generator thing that Hugo wrote that creates the badge on the fly. When people turn up, we give them a badge, and it prints the logo on their badge of the distro that they use. So really? When you walk in the room, you can immediately spot things someone like who's like-minded and uses the same.
So that's the thing, though, isn't it? It's about sharing best practice.
Yeah, exactly. Among
best practice.
Leveraging our market opportunity. Sharing best practice.
A good reason why that works in our lug. Would it work in another lug? I don't know. But they might benefit from the suggestion.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, Popey. I mean, you do sound like you know a great deal of... you know, of that stuff. It's what I wanted to say, right? It's what I wanted to say. What should people do if they've got a burning cystite? No, if they've got a burning problem.
Burning ring. Call the fire brigade.
They've got a burning desire to help the UK lug Woojima flip. What should they do?
Contact their local lug.
Right. Thanks.
Their local lug can do much more for them than we can.
Okay, cool.
Because we're, like I say, we're a service provider. We provide the hosting and that.
Makes sense
their
to me.
Their local lug, can provide them with, you know, expertise on the ground. You know, there's times when you see people asking questions on mailing lists and saying, look, I've got a broken PC. Could someone please just come to my house and fix this? And there's no way that, you know, lug.org.uk can go around the country fixing people's PCs. But, you know, a charitable member of their local lug might well be willing to do that for a cup of tea and a biscuit or something.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, well, cheers, Popey. It's been good talking to you. And hopefully we can encourage people to get along to their local lug and make a difference.
Vote President Pope.
Joke.popey.com.
Catch you later, Popey.
See you later, Popey.
Thanks for joining us.
Matthew P. Revelle got a new job.
Yeah.
Yay. Tell us about
you.
Congratulations.
Well, blow me, I've got a new job.
No thanks.
Basically,
well done.
Basically, I've been in discussions with a small company.
Redder.
Canonical. for a few months now about the possibility of me
and
joining
the creep
them.
Carries on. That's 2 out of 4 now.
At least Matt's not going to ask for jobs in interviews now.
Yeah, that's true.
For about a month.
No.
I don't know. I mean, it's his policy of asking people who we interview for a job has clearly been a success.
What are you talking about? He's not working at Microsoft.
So what are you going to be doing, Matt? Come on,
so, tell us about your
job. Right, so anyway, eventually I was offered the role of Launchpad Marketing Manager. Basically, cool. Launchpad, for those of you who don't know, is Canonical's suite of kind of online developer tools. There's bug tracking, you can create specifications and things like that. There's also translations for a bit of software called Rosetta.
If people are wondering what that noise was, it's because Matt had taken the pop shield off.
John, do you want to tell them what pop shield was?
Which was a sock. And I just pointed out to Matt that there is no pop shield on, so he's just taking his sock off.
See, we are consummate professionals.
And slid it over the microphone like the sheath that it is.
We can buy some more pop shields.
I'll tell you what, I imagine John Humphreys has to do exactly the same thing on the Today programme. He just doesn't tell everyone about it when it happens.
Carry on, Matt.
Anyway, Matt, sorry, carry on.
We know that you're an award-winning marketeer now. So you're going to be very, very good at it?
Obviously. so you can do translations and there's also distributed version control through Bazaar. So it's a whole various load of things. And the idea is that people, different open source projects can all, can use either all or some of the facilities on Launchpad. And because
I know a project that's just started using that.
Jokosha.
Jokosha has indeed moved today.
We moved this afternoon to
the bug tracking. But you guys were using the translations beforehand. The idea is that basically I'll be the in many ways the public voice of Launchpad, but behind the scenes I'll do all the non-comms aspects of marketing Launchpad as well.
Non-comms, what's that mean?
I'll be researching the users and trying to work out, you know, maybe writing documentation for it, things like that.
Gotcha. Cool. Now, as I understand it, Launchpad is not open source.
Elements of it aren't.
Elephants.
Right. Okay.
I did have difficulty saying that.
Which elements of it are?
Bazaar.
Right, okay.
But we will be opening up other bits as time goes on.
I was going to ask you, is there a time frame for this? And is that on the roadmap, so to speak?
There isn't a time frame that I know of, but there is an intention, let's put it that way. Right. And this is something that obviously I gave a lot of thought to when I was being offered the job and deciding whether to take it, and when I eventually did take it.
I was under the impression they went, do you want a job? And you went, does it pay money? And they said yes, and you went, cool, sign me up then.
So at what point...
Just taking a step outside of my professional capacity. Fuck off. back into my
capacity. At what point when you were begging for the job, did you make these points?
Listen, I think we'll be very mean to
we're
poor
only
Matthew.
Joking. We're only
yes,
joking.
We all are, aren't we?
So anyway.
Particularly Aid.
Going back to the serious point of it being open source or not, and thank you for raising that.
that's why I was surprised that these two signed Jokosha up to it.
Well... I think the thing is, not wanting to butt in, but quite clearly.
Butting in regardless, against your own will, it appears.
The thing is, Launchpad's closed source.
Yeah.
But the thing is... My personal impression is that, the idea behind Launchpad is to build a centralized suite of tools that a lot of different distros, a lot of different projects will use. The thing is, if you set that up and then you make it open source, everybody will set up their own Launchpad and their own centralized suite of tools to enable people to work together. So... if you want to build something centralized, you have to, in some ways, restrict the ability for that thing to be set up by everybody.
We love restrictions in the open source world, don't we?
So the thing is that...
this harks back a bit to a discussion we had in the last series, or possibly the series before that, about freeness of web applications generally.
Yes. Mm.
There's only one Gmail.
My point is that a lot of people in the free software world are very happy to use SourceForge. Or they're very happy to use Gmail or Google Spreadsheets, some people now.
Oh, yeah.
And they don't talk about whether it's open source or not. And I'm not saying that I don't want things to be open source, because I do support open source, you know, and I'm a free software fan.
Well, it's nice to know it's in the...
But, and the point is, to me, the reason that I... largely, the main reason that I support free software is because it guarantees that I've got ownership of my data part. That's one of the reasons, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that the Launchpad team are planning is to make it as easy as possible, and in some areas you already can, to get your data in and out of Launchpad. You retain all ownership of it. And so they're not going to... So if Canonical went away, then you would still be able to have access to your data, because you'd be able to back it up and things like that.
And ultimately, it is you are planning to open source it eventually anyway.
The thing is, as well, is that there's no... Yeah, I mean, imagine... They're planning to, you know, part Canonical as well, but the Launchpad team are planning to open source chunks of it as it goes along, which seems the same step, because then the system builds, a critical mass of projects that are on that system. And the good thing, of course,
can you leverage anything?
part of the reason why...
Don't wave that at me.
Jono waves his penis.
Well, you know, it takes two hands. Part of the reason why we've moved the Jokosha bug tracker over is, one of the reasons is because obviously Ubuntu uses Launchpad. And one of the nice things is that a lot of our users use Ubuntu. And if they're logging bugs in Launchpad and we're logging bugs upstream in Launchpad, then Launchpad makes it nice about the relationship between those different types of bugs.
Yeah.
So theoretically, if you've got Fedora on there and if you've got You know, maybe Linspire on there.
What did GStreamer do for their bugs?
They use the GNOME Bugzilla. And right. Launchpad does talk to other bug tracking systems.
Yeah, that's it's quite a bit.
It's a pretty clever system, to be fair to them.
I mean, I, speaking purely for myself here, when we had the discussion today about where we should move the Chikosha bug tracking stuff to, the two basic choices were Launchpad and the GNOME Bugzilla.
Yeah.
Now, we spoke to the GNOME Bugzilla guys before, and they said they were happy for us to put stuff there if we wanted to. And obviously we looked at Launchpad. And I personally was conflicted about using Launchpad because of its non-free nature. Mm. But on the flip side, we're already managing our translations in it. Mm. And if we set it up in the GNOME Bugzilla, then the project would exist in three places. Our current bug tracking system, which we intend to still use for developer documentation, and in Launchpad for bug tracking translations, and in the GNOME Bugzilla. And no matter how much Launchpad hooks into other stuff, it's not as good as having it all in the one place. Plus, this is me trying to be pragmatic, which I could get into trouble for not being.
Yeah, that's
the thing is, as well, I'm absolutely convinced that if it wasn't for Rosetta, which is the translations bit of Launchpad, if it wasn't for that, we wouldn't have the level of translations that we've got in Chikosha right now. If we'd have basically said, we're supporting GetText in Chikosha and just go away and use whatever tools you use to make these translations, I'm pretty convinced that we wouldn't have as many because Rosetta's so easy to use.
Yeah, you literally just open it up, type in the translation, and then click save.
Exactly, and that's nice. So, you know, like Axe says, you know, if we've got, we're using Rosetta anyway, and Launchpad offers these other benefits. And the other thing is that Launchpad, I believe, although it's not the perfect bug tracker, I don't believe such a thing exists, because they've all got their issues.
Yeah.
It's a pretty reasonable bug tracker, and it's easy for the reporter, that's the important thing. Mm. Problem with Bugzilla is that, unless you're using, for example, the GNOME Simple Bug Guide, then if you're going to report with a normal Bugzilla, there's loads of boxes and confusing things that you're asked for.
Absolutely, but we had no intention of using someone else's Bugzilla. The GNOME Bugzilla is the one that we would have used, and they've done an absolutely superb job taking Bugzilla, which is horrific and complicated, and making it good.
Yeah.
They really have done.
The other GNOME good Bugzilla thing team that I quite like about Malone, which is the Launchpad Bugzilla, Bug Tracker, sorry, is that it will talk to dead bugs, it'll talk to SourceForge, and it'll talk to Bugzilla. And those are the only ones at the moment, but I'm sure it'll
track
expand.
As well.
Track, does it?
Yeah. I was under the impression they didn't talk to Track, but he's convinced that they do, don't they?
Yes, it does talk to Track, because I hooked the Ubuntu bugs, bugs filed about Chikosha against the Ubuntu package of Chikosha, not upstream bugs. I hooked them into our upstream bugs in Track, and it does it.
Right.
And people can tell me it won't do it, and I've done it already. But now, of course, we're
take a chill pill.
Now, of course, we're going to be moving those bugs from our Track install into Malone.
Yeah.
Which, incidentally, is a pain in the arse, because as far as I can tell, there's no way of importing all the bugs.
See,
you have to just type them all in by hand.
I've got a way
to get the Launchpad team to help you.
Yeah. Well, yes, I'm going to be looking at that and see if there's something we can do with that. But, I mean, I don't want to bang on about my new job too much more, but
Away.
The main thing I would say is that, yeah, open source, I'm sure that is something that will come up time and time again, but I think that there are ways around it, and I think there are good reasons for it not being open source, such as the idea of, because Launchpad is all about working to be like a central point for free software projects, whether or not they use it. So it aggregates bugs from different bug trackers, all that sort of thing. So if you report a bug about Chikosha and it happens to be actually a Python bug, then Malone knows that it's all the same bug and will track the bug's progress throughout Python for you and all that.
The thing is that Launchpad, if you imagine every single project was on Launchpad, which is obviously, it's never going to be like that. Be nice if a lot of projects run there, but it really will make the world of bug triaging and reporting all the rest of it so much easier. And I think as more and more chunks of it join up, and as Launchpad can talk to upstream bug tracking systems and things like that, it really will make things easier. I think the idea behind it is absolutely superb. I mean, just speaking, not as a canonical person, speaking personally, I think it's got its fair share of usability problems, which I know are being addressed.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a really complicated piece of software to write something like that, and I don't think anybody gets it right first time round. And in general, it's all right, but I know that people who've been trying to register specs for Mountain View and things like that have had a few problems and quirks, even experienced users. So I think they're trying to work on that. But the thing I like is that the Launchpad team are very open to suggestions and want to make sure that it's a really good piece of software. And obviously, Matt's going to be part of that team. So,
well, congratulations, yeah. mate.
No, congratulations. We're really pleased. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Well, so, 50% of the Lug Radio team now work for Canonical.
It should be stressed that Canonical are not trying some kind of takeover of Lug Radio.
No,
they are not.
Yes, we are all individuals. Presumably this is like the joke of about the guy in prison who has his tonsils out and has his teeth out and whatever, because he's trying to smuggle himself out bit by bit. They're not just going to buy out Lug Radio and make it Canonical Radio. They're just going to gradually assimilate us one by one.
The only thing that's left is Axe arse cheeks.
If I was,
no one wants that.
If I was trying to set up a serious Linux services company,
you'd employ you?
I would not try and buy out Lug Radio as my mouthpiece.
But that's why you wouldn't be massively successful. So if there are any Linux service companies out there who'd like to buy us out, checks on a postcard.
So yeah, so when Canonical
checks on a postcard.
Yeah.
How's that work then?
You staple a check to a postcard.
Okay.
So when Canonical are hugely successful and, you know, ruling the world, then it was our...
Yeah, fantastic.
We made it happen.
I bet you're pleased about that, Aid.
I think a reasonable proportion of the free software, the open source community, not everybody, but a reasonable proportion, would say that there's nothing that proprietary software companies in the proprietary software world can do that we can't match. There isn't software where it's just too hard for us.
Can't or haven't?
Can't. Not
physically.
I don't think you would say right now there is definitely an open source replacement for every proprietary piece
of
software.
Okay.
Right.
I just wanted to clear that one.
No idea that someone could come up with that you could do in a proprietary world that you couldn't do it in the open source.
So there's a possibility to match that kind of functionality with free software.
Yeah. I think broadly most of the open source community would agree with that.
Okay, I'm going to give you this one.
Yeah, I mean, not everybody, and you may disagree, but I think most people would. One of the things that concerns me a bit is that we're still entirely reliant on the proprietary world for hardware to run it on. We can't ever do hardware. All we can do is wait till someone else comes up with hardware and then try and put free software on it.
Yeah,
So, you know, HP go, we're going to make iPacks. And you go, okay, now we've got to port Linux to those iPacks. But there aren't that many people going, we're going to build a device just to run Linux on it. I mean, there are a few people doing it. The GP32s are like that, for example. The game console things.
That's
not open. Carry on.
No. I'm not talking about hardware being open specifically, although that would be good.
But it's financially difficult,
well,
surely.
That's exactly the point. People say, the open source community...
you can create software for nothing.
It works in a different way to the proprietary community generally. And you've got this huge mass of people all around the world just communicating by IRC, and we can match anything they can do. One of the things you can't do is build hardware, because no matter how many people you've got on IRC, you don't have a fab plant for making chips.
Yeah, exactly.
For example. Yeah. Yeah. But is that a problem, a limitation?
Depends. I mean, in the business world, you do things because it gives the customer benefit. And that to build hardware, you would need a lot of money, as you say. And I don't think there would be enough of a benefit from saying it's built to run Linux. At the moment, than there would be to say it's built to be a really good set-top box,
well,
and we
like
happen
TomTom
to use
might
Linux.
Be interested, isn't it?
No, because the benefit that Axe saying is that it should be...
Think of all the appliance makers out there. You know, if they could buy a piece of hardware that was guaranteed, you know, it was built for Linux, it's an ideal piece of appliance hardware.
But that's largely what kind of OEMs are there for, isn't it? Is to take chunks of hardware, make sure stuff runs in it, and then they maybe sell that as a solution to other companies. That's where a lot of the embedded companies kind of come in. I mean, I'd say that... I think it largely depends on the industry at that present time. So, for example, mid-80s, everything was completely fragmented, so a lot of people wanted to sell BASIC. And they'd have to make different versions of BASIC for all these different computers, because they all had different architectures, hardware architectures. So it was really difficult to make... essentially, every computer was proprietary. Whereas with the IBM PC, of course, you can buy, the clones, you can buy...
That's standardised, but it's not open, is it?
Yeah, but I think the thing is...
I'm not necessarily talking about openness in the hardware. It's that the open source community can't generate hardware. We've basically got to sit there and say to people, and wait till someone else comes up with something, and they're only going to come up with it if they've got a proprietary motive to do so, and then try and put free software on it. I mean, possibly you can go to hardware manufacturers and say,
so it's always a reaction.
We'd like to write this... But we don't have the pull to convince other people to do it for us.
You're talking about chips.
We can't do it ourselves.
Or are you talking about systems?
Not just chips. Well, but not too long ago. Since it all boils down to chips, basically, yes, I'm talking about chips.
Not too long ago. Shut up, you pie eater. Not so long ago, we talked to the guy who was getting ready to do the first open source graphics card.
Tamer.
Well, yeah, but
yeah, Tim Airbloke.
Yeah, I mean the Open Graphics Project. I absolutely applaud what they're doing, but so far they've been doing it a couple of years. I still can't go and buy one of these cards, and when I do, it'll be £2,000.
No, but the first one they produce is intended as a graphics card that we would use.
It's intended for like high processing use.
Fair place, but then my argument is
it's the second one that he produces.
That's the point. Do you believe then that we're starting to get to the stage where we'll be able to generate hardware as well as software? This is the OGP, the Open Graphics Project, just very early stages of that.
I think it depends. I think the thing is that basically what you're saying is that right now we're dependent on other people making hardware, companies making hardware, many of which don't have, some of which don't have an appreciation of free software. So there's essentially a vulnerability there. There's a point of failure there. I think it's always easy to kind of question the next layer up. So we're saying, imagine, you know, if we managed to make open source hardware, then people would start saying, yeah, but what about if I, you know, what about if I wanted a different kind of power other than electricity or other than solar power or that kind of thing? You're always going to question the next layer up. At some point, you're going to have some trust that layer is going to be there, and it's going to be there relatively in your best interest.
Now,
that's why I was comparing like the mid 80s. Back then, I'd have been as concerned as you are. But now, although you've got people like Apple making specific machines and you've got Sun making specific machines, the thing is, the majority of the industry is dominated by the IBM PC standard, you know, and I don't think that's going to change any time soon.
The majority of the computer industry, I mean, embedded devices and all that.
Sure, I'm talking about general kind of computer use.
You know, I mean, and Trolltech have done the green phone and stuff like that. But, I mean, if, for instance, I wanted to set up a company selling Linux laptops, as far as I'm aware at the moment, I have to buy someone else's laptop and then put Linux on it.
Unless you've got a factory, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, but that's the point. I don't see how the open source community is ever going to graduate to a stage where it's got a factory.
Well, how's it graduated to the point that it has with software?
Because software's always free. You can make software freely.
No, but you can't buy bread and food freely, and you have to pay developers a lot of the time to get to a certain a point, don't you? Because, you know, a lot of software has got to a very, very good point, but then when you're talking about taking, say, a server operating system to enterprise, then you need a lot of support services around that, so you have to have a business model. And so why wouldn't it be that there may one day be a hardware company that comes up and says, right, there's a business model now to sell hardware specifically for Linux systems. I mean, look at Sun with their servers. They're now, hate to mention them again, but they're working with Canonical to make sure that Ubuntu runs really well on the Niagara servers. So why wouldn't that happen for laptops one day? Once there is enough of a market, you know, I mean, you've got people like the Linux Emporium who are taking third-party laptops and selling some, admittedly fairly expensively. But if there was, say, if Linux had, say, a 15 or 20% market share on the desktop, then I'm sure that Linux Emporium would be able to get themselves either a third-party manufacturer
and
or their own little
ODM laptops rather than OEM laptops. I mean, I understand what you're saying. I mean, I suppose the core of my argument boils down to, if you wanted to, the community, pure community, nothing to do with money or paying developers or anything, could put together a Linux distribution. Right, you don't have to pay anybody. Yes, you probably want to motivate people enough and to focus on the right things and possibly to get Linux to where it is today.
Yep.
But at least theoretically, you could just get everyone together on IRC and everyone writes code in their spare time and come up with Ubuntu or Fedora Core.
Yeah.
Without paying anybody. But no matter how much you do that, you've got to have money to build hardware.
Just as I can't have a free yacht.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, tough.
Oh, okay. I mean,
the thing is as well is that, I mean,
there's always this kind of idea that, you know, okay, if Novell and Canonical and Red Hat all walked away, then it wouldn't kill Linux, it wouldn't kill open source software.
Yeah.
But you've got to have people like that involved for hardware.
I think it's a paranoid view, though.
I don't think they're ever going to walk away.
There'll always be a market for an open.
No, I'm not suggesting they're going to walk away or anything like that. It's just kind of a different shift. There's not that kind of.
Yeah, but I think it's
psychological safety net.
It's basically saying, I don't know, this extremely unlikely thing might happen. So therefore, no, we've got to be worried about
Let's take the emphasis off of Red Hat and all that. It was just an example, wasn't it, them walking away. The point is that you are concerned or perhaps slightly concerned.
Did you
want to
spit when you said that, by the way?
You what?
Did you want to spit when you said that?
Spit?
Yeah. Red Hat. Red Hat.
Oh, shut up. Fucking bald twat.
There was some venom behind that.
I was joking.
Yeah.
No, seriously.
Please, no.
You're slightly concerned that there isn't the possibility for the community to create hardware. But at the same time, there isn't the possibility for...
That guy made a wind-up radio.
He did, but he had to involve the University of Bristol to actually make it efficient enough to become a market.
Didn't he have to get like funding from somewhere? You have to get angel funding or something like that.
Yeah, and he had to get the university involved, and then he had to set up a factory in South Africa and all that.
If there's enough of a need, you would be able to do it.
I think there's a difference between a wind-up radio, which is a largely mechanical object, and CPUs.
If there was a need, though, we would invent.
But the point that Stuart is making is not that a bloke, say us four, could go and sit in a garage and come up with a new laptop design and get some funding to get it made. Stuart, I believe you're saying is that the community cannot, without outside funding, come up with its own hardware. And it's true, it can't.
I was under the impression what he's saying is that fundamentally, if the hardware manufacturers decide to screw us or they go away,
or then all of our down with DRM and
yeah, then all of our software is basically at risk because we've got no control over that layer.
That's the conclusion.
You're both right. What I was... the thought that was in my mind is broadly what Matt was saying, that it is kind of a weakness. It's not an area we can go into without saying, okay, now we have to get companies involved and money involved and start working out how to get a revenue stream and all that. Which you could do the software without that if you want to. I don't think it'd make as good software, and I think it's important.
Yeah, sure, but it's possible.
But you could do it without it, but you can't do that with hardware. You just can't.
I think.
But the conclusion from that is exactly what Jono was saying.
Yeah, I mean,
a conclusion
from that.
I think the other thing is that, one possible option would be is if you decided, let's assume, you know, in a wonderful world that an open source computer could be developed. Okay, you make this thing and it runs Linux perfectly and it does something slightly different. Then let's say it only runs Linux. Then what happens is we start getting into essentially what Apple are doing, and it's not a profitable thing. It's not probably
a load
of
Windows users trying to port Windows onto it.
I mean, yeah, but the point
you can't do that with Windows, and that's the point.
But the point, finishing off, the point I'm making is that I mean, Apple have made a fairly successful business out of what they do,
selling iPods,
and but they sell shitloads of iPods, and they're a hardware business, but they still only account for a minority of the market, and
they account for the majority of the music player market.
Sure,
I mean,
in this discussion, we're predominantly talking about normal computers.
No, I'm not particularly. That's the point. I mean, the reason this
earlier on we excluded embedded stuff, didn't we?
No, we didn't. We didn't at all. Embedded stuff was a specific example of
this. Yes, yeah.
I mean, the reason this came about is that if I wanted a piece of software that did something, and we didn't have, there was a proprietary one that did that, but there was no free software one. I'm aware that if I really wanted it, I could sit down and write it. You know, I mean, I might have to do quite a lot of learning if what I wanted was GStreamer or the Linux kernel or something, but I could do it. There's nothing actually preventing me from doing so.
Yeah, yeah.
But no matter how much I want it and how much I wish and how many books I read, I cannot make hardware. You know, I just can't.
Not on your own, but the same way...
I can't make... No matter how much I want... If Apple hadn't invented the iPod and I thought to myself, what I'd really like is... A music player that plays MP3s and some DRM format, and it's got nice rounded corners and it's got a really good user interface. I could do the user interface and design it myself, but no matter how much I wish for, I couldn't actually make the hardware. It's made really, it the size of my garage.
It's basically
you could have a really, really big breadboard.
That's the point. I couldn't do it no matter how much
but
I wanted.
But it's the same
it.
As you couldn't build a house on your own, I'm willing to bet.
You're basically bottlenecked at money.
It's not just money, it's skills and replicability.
Oh, yeah, but the way we get around the skills issue in the open source community generally, you know, back to everything Raymond said in the Cathedral and the Bazaar, to enough eyes, all the bugs are shallow. There's going to be someone in the open source community somewhere who understands paper sizes, to take Jono's favourite example of this.
Or
how to do order one scheduling, if you want to talk about the kernel or whatever. Okay. But no matter how much expertise you've got in the community about how to make chips, no one can actually make the chips because we don't have any fab plants. We don't have any money to do it with.
But I mean,
I don't know if it's a problem or a weakness or
assuming that we don't need to actually make chips because plenty of people do it. And let's assume that just for now that there will always be enough chips that we'll
do
what we want.
Is it okay to plug chips onto a board though? Or do you actually want to make the chips as well?
No, it's okay to plug chips onto a board, but can you make the board and can you make the case the board goes in?
But the thing is that, I mean, that you've got to start looking at it maybe as a broader definition of community involvement. So there might be plenty of guys who could get together and come up with, say, the blueprints or whatever you call them for the PCBs and all of that, yeah?
Yeah.
And then there might be somebody else who's either got a lot of money and is prepared to fund it within the community.
Has he been into space?
Possibly.
He'd be the one guy we're talking about here.
Or there's someone else who is really good at speaking to venture capitalists and getting a good deal from them. The point is that you can't directly transfer the way that we do things with software to hardware. Not going to happen.
My point.
It doesn't have to be a weakness, though, because we can evolve what the community is about and the way that the community works by taking other skills from the community, such as getting money and getting funding and getting a good deal from it so that it remains open and remains community owned.
I don't believe you can, because I think the thing with our current community is where we've managed to move forward is that fundamentally, free software development is about modification, and when you modify something, you can pass it on. And that doesn't cost anything, with the exception of bandwidth and stuff like that. It's basically extremely cheap to pass that on. Mm. You cannot sufficiently develop hardware and modify it and improve it.
But we're not talking about modifying and improving. We're talking about something that comes from the community and is suitable for our purposes. We're not talking about applying the free software model. We're talking about applying the community model to hardware.
I understand that, but the community model is about working together to refine ideas and make things happen. And you can't do that with hardware without it costing an awful lot of money. You basically, that's where the bottleneck is that you need a lot of money to do that. And of course, for people to stump up that money, you need some kind of profit-making scheme.
Unless you've
got someone who wants to chuck their money in.
And that's what I'm saying. That's why you have a slightly broader definition of what community involvement is. Otherwise, you go back to the thing that you can't have a free yacht and it's tough.
So what would be your definition of community then?
I'd be including people like Red Hat or people like Novell or other companies or people who are prepared to come into the community and play by our rules and work within it, but still have their business model that enables them to make a return on their investment.
But I don't understand where the word community matches hardware.
Because what I'm saying is you have to broaden the definition of
what I'm saying to you is give me the definition. Of what you're talking about, of how the word community and this broadened definition of community can make that hardware possible.
Because
that's the thing I don't get.
A community doesn't just have to be a bunch of hairy geeks sitting on IRC.
Sure.
It can be companies, it can be universities, it can be non-profit organisations and government institutions.
Sure, but that coalition of people working together, I don't understand how that makes the hardware thing happen.
Because people like IBM
have resources.
Yeah, they do. But it still fundamentally relies on creating designs and improving those designs.
Yes. So
between this coalition of people.
Yeah. Okay. So what's the problem with that?
The point I'm making is that for that to happen, you need a certain amount of money. Now, yes, you could source that money.
Yeah, and so am I saying that as well.
You could source that money from IBM, and it's relatively impractical. But what I'm saying is that the community process, when we refer to community traditionally, refers to how people work together to make certain things happen, and those things always happen in a series of incremental steps.
Yeah.
Now, if you've got people who've got money in those incremental steps, yes, theoretically it's possible.
And the way that hardware, as I understand it, is designed is that computer prototypes are created, and you model it within a computer simulation. And you can do all the iterative steps through that, and then you create a prototype. And if the prototype works out, then you go into production, having made the necessary changes.
Sure.
But it basically still is.
I mean, I think a lot of stuff can be done electronically, and
it's
like virtualization essentially for the electronics world. But I think it fundamentally revolves in lots of revving, and that's, I suppose, where the primary difference is, and that's the primary reason why it's not happened. You know, is that revving in the hardware world costs money, and revving in the software world doesn't.
It would cost money, but again, it goes back to free yacht. You're not going to get one.
Yeah, exactly.
In a break with tradition.
How is that a break with tradition? You just did it.
What is it, Aid?
It's the end of the show.
Yay! We considered breaking with tradition, but
no, fuck that.
We're
shit.
All far too superstitious.
Yes, yeah. From the award-winning Lug Radio.
Yes. Did we mention that, by the way?
Once or twice.
John Thomas writes in, and he said,
"John Thomas,
he's got indeed,
his name. He's fucking dick.
You appear to be named after a penis, there, Mr. Thomas.
Sorry."
Are we laughing at someone's name?
Yes.
Oh, good. Yeah, I've got an email here from someone called Harry Bellen.
After hearing the email on episode 4 regarding open source naming conventions. Do you remember this one? Yeah?
Yes, yeah? Indeed.
I decided that
open
I would
source naming conventions.
Open source animal naming
conventions. Oh, right. Yes.
I missed
that.
The word animal out there.
Pretty critical word.
I decided I'd do the same and rename my cat to...
Fuck words.
Sarge. She weighs about the same as a stack of Debian CDs. When I told this to my non-computer savvy grandmother,
as well.
She became very confused. Clearly, she doesn't understand the importance of open source animal naming conventions and their role in the spread of open source software. P.S. Excellent show. I greatly enjoy seeing it live over here in the States. Regards, Mr. John Thomas.
Surely anything weighs the same as a stack of Debian CDs.
Do you think the cat
depends how big the stack is? Yeah. Wise words from Matthew.
Do you think that the cats are accepting the Debian free cat guidelines?
No, I think the cat just argues with itself all the time.
And the thing is, the cat just never gets released.
You see, the advantage with cats is you don't have to distribute them because they fucking redistribute themselves.
Do you think someone down the road has cloned it, painted it brown, and called it Ubuntu?
Stop! Stop the cat mayhem. Onwards and possibly.
Do you think there's one that's got like a really glitzy rhinestone collar and it's called Free Spire?
Rename all of your pets and send their names into the show at lugradio.org.
One thing we were talking about earlier on was maybe having a little gallery of your pets.
No, we weren't.
This is before you showed up
at 9:30 tonight. That's a very
good point. So the two guys
get here earlier.
Large penis or whatever his name was. And the guy last week who named his cat GNU/Linux. if you could send us pictures of your cats, that would be absolutely excellent. I'll put together a gallery on the website. The Tony Art gallery. Yeah. It would be copyrighted.
Someone's got to have a pet GNU. You know, maybe call that a normal name.
You should rename your dogs.
No, I'm not renaming the dogs.
You could rename the dogs. Dapper and Edgy.
No.
The new one could be called Edgy because it's Danny.
Danny.
No. Anyway, moving around in a counterclockwise direction.
So yeah, send us pictures of your animals that you've renamed.
In England, it means anti-clockwise.
I've just seen Matt's eyeball actually spin round in a circle to see if that's the right way. That was quite weird, Matt.
But I didn't actually look at his watch.
You remind me of someone. Anyway.
I looked into Matt's eyes earlier and I noticed that the irises were broken up into three individual segments.
No, they were in different kind of shades of brown and orange.
As Aid gazed into Matt's eyes. Anyway.
Well, I don't have the MSN Spaces logo in my eyes.
Why is there an F tattooed on your forehead?
The fuckwit.
Gazing into his brown eye. Oh. Carry on.
Right, I've got one from Monkey.
He says, Monkey!
Thank you. He says, Stuart is right.
No, he isn't.
Despite the fact that in X years' time we may have 30 to 40% of the desktop market, he was going to show people that we should press for a free open codex. Oh. We should not roll over.
We'll never have 30 to 40% with this attitude.
Harumph.
Big it up. Well done, Monkey.
So I take it I missed...
Is it signed .sil?
No. I take it I missed something last week to do with...
Just like being wrong again.
It's at least one person who thinks that you two, who are prepared to just sell us up the river in order to play MP3s, are wrong.
Yeah, but that person picks nits out of his mate's arse. So,
Monkey.
Can you get nits around his arse area?
Arse nits. Right. Not to be confused with arse mitts.
Come on.
You seem to know a lot about arses, Jono.
No, I don't. Anyway, yeah, we'll not subject you to Jono's favourite toilet stories right now. Eric Raymond's view is the subject of Joseph Gaffney, brother of the ugly Dean Teen. Gaffney.
what face was that you just pulled?
Sorry, I was readjusting myself. And it was painful. I've got some serious issues with Eric Raymond's POV.
No.
That's an AV consultant, I know that I know what Linux is lacking, and it really is not MP3 playback. To be honest, it's MP3 as a format that's lacking, along with every other MPEG codec, and that needs to be played up. Now, MP3 isn't really used as a standard, more of a de facto standard. MPEG-4, AAC, Chris Waddle, however, is the standard, Dolby uses that, blah, 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 boring stuff. Then he says, now, I'm not a total zealot. Trust me, I've got an iPod. I don't believe there's any argument. He says, but I am an asshole, and that means I send regular emails to Apple asking them to support OGG.
The trouble is, the iPod's too weedy to support OGG, isn't it?
Because
it doesn't have hardware OGG.
He hasn't got a hardware OGG decoder, quite right. You have to do it in software, and it's too hard.
What he does do, the bastard that he is he's filled the page with...
How do iWivers do it, then?
Because they are basically a Linux PC, yeah. Which is why they wear a ton of...
My Ultra's got 400 megahertz chip CPU in it.
Which makes it happen.
It's ARM or something like that.
Mr. Gaffney fills half of this page with winky smiles, which is not amusing.
It's very amusing, actually.
Speaking of winky smiles...
He's not the only person to have a pop at Mr. Bacon.
Some of these bastards seem to think that it was good to send me pages of winky smiles. There's one in particular which acts a special script that prints out our emails, which is closed-sourced.
Have you released it?
I can release the script if you'd like me to. I don't know what you're fucking talking about, because the other half of that bloke's page says wiki over and over again. Oh, so I'd shut the fuck up if I was you, bald man.
But there's one person...
I'll release the script.
There was one person who... And useful it will be too.
not at all useful. It'll be useful if you have my mailbox and you print emails for Lug Radio, but I'm happy to open it if you'd like me to.
But there's one person who said...
I think maybe there should only be one copy of this script, and everyone should just come and use it rather than having their own copy.
Fair enough.
yeah, I agree.
There's one...
.net.
Launchpad.net, incidentally.
Would you shut the fuck up, please? There's one person who sent an email which merely comprises entirely of smartly winky faces, and this person put so many in there that when Act Script resized them small to fit them on the page, all you can see is a grey page.
Let's have a look.
Look at that. It's like a shit magic eye picture.
Wow, really weird. Then.
What the script does is it takes your an individual email and it basically shrinks the font size it all fits on the page, and it'll get down as far as a 3-pixel font size before it gives up, which is that's how far it went down.
I did hear that you love the winky though.
No,
you do love winky smiles.
I don't love them. At all.
So you got email from who's that guy?
I don't know. The text is too small. I can't read it.
His name should be at the top.
No, it says Matt.
Oh, there you go.
The text that actually says it is way too small. So I don't like the winky faces, and I don't like people who say pointless words on IRC like moin and re.
For the win.
And for the win, FTW. No, for the losers, that's right. So, carry on.
It's the harshness. Andrew Smith from Toronto in Canada.
Damn him.
Writes in to shill his piece of software in a shameful, shameful fashion.
What's his software?
We're going to shill it anyway.
Yeah. So we're going
to say someone else's software.
So we're going to shill it anyway. Yeah. He says, I was wondering, would you mention Jackfield on the show? He writes in to mention a piece of software called Jacosha, which the thing he's written is called ISO Master. It's apparently a GPL'd ISO editor for Linux, created in the scratch your own itch tradition of open source. It's a little svr.ca/isomaster. He says, I mean, the reason he got this read out is not just because he wrote in and said, please shill my bit of software. He actually has a question.
It's because we find ISOs really interesting.
Maybe you can ask your listeners and discuss on the next show, how does one go about adding his package to the official repositories of distributions like Ubuntu, Fedora, or SUSE?
Yeah.
What you do is you go and find Daniel Holbach and say, package this for Ubuntu for us, will you? Yeah. And he goes, okay then.
I'd seriously say that part of it is making a lot of people know about your software, and then these people tend to come to you anyway.
Exactly. I mean, if your software's good, people will come to you and say, we'd like you in the thing. If you get involved in the communities for those distributions...
Not wanting to disagree with you just then, because I agree with your general viewpoint, but you're basically saying if your software's not popular, it's not good. Which isn't entirely true.
Okay, no. That was a bit of an unfair characterisation, I agree with you.
Sure, it'd help if you packaged it up, though, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, one good way definitely is to package it yourself and then make it available, so people can get it. And then if it ends up being in the official repository, people are more likely to pick it up if they can just drop it into the official repository.
I don't know if packaging it yourself
is necessarily a good idea, and it's quite hot.
No, I was going to say, I don't know if packaging it yourself necessarily accidentally ends up in the official repository. From what I've seen of the, particularly the Fedora process, it's a pretty tortuous road.
Oh, it is a tortuous road.
To make it happen.
But it's going to be a bit easier if a Fedora developer says, oh, I'd like to put this into a yummable repository, and it's already packaged, all they've got to do is just drop it in. Whereas if they have to package it up themselves and make their own RPMs, then it's going to be a little bit harder.
Definitely. Get someone on board who knows packaging. That's all
basically, just be involved with the Ubuntu community or the Fedora community or the SUSE community. Into all three of them and talk to some people. And
or the tiny sofa community.
It's an interesting question.
It is an interesting question. Thanks for your email.
Yeah. He says he's been listening to Lug Radio for 2 years and he's happy to report that your shows are still great. Good job. Thank you very much. So thank you very much, Andrew Smith from Toronto.
It concerned me for a while that people might get bored of it, and I'm pleased that we've got long-term listeners still.
We've got people with a similar short memory as us.
Yeah, and too much time. So, Adrian.
Adrian, hello. Yes. Magnus Thierning writes in.
Again.
Yay.
And he's wrong about a couple of things, in my opinion.
Well, he usually is.
So he says, we don't need proprietary media codecs on the Linux desktop. Just wait, Microsoft will in fact do all the work for us. The current death march into DRM land, blah, 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 blah. Basically, he's saying that Microsoft are going to make it so hard for us to play content that the consumers will revolt and not buy the content.
What complete bullshit.
So he's wrong on that one. But the thing that he's most wrong on is the last line in his email. Ack for Prime Minister of Great Britain and leader of the free world.
We like that.
So no, we don't like that at all.
No.
He's extremely wrong for that. That would be a complete and unmitigated disaster.
If there is hope, it lies in the proles, as Winston Smith told us, and he was wrong about it too.
What did Winston Smith say?
If there is hope, it lies in the proles, yes.
Mm. Incidentally,
I'm not convinced, to be honest with you, that the whole, they'll just make it a pain in the arse until eventually the people will rise up and demand freedom.
No, they'll just roll over and ask to be raped again.
Yes, they will.
Thanks for that image. I suspect Mark's going to want me to take that out of the show.
Who?
I suspect you're going to want me to take that particular statement out of the show.
No, I don't care anymore.
Oh, nice.
Okay, first. I've got a ridiculously long email from Brad Phipps, who says, hi guys.
Long emails don't get read.
No, I'm going to take a little highlight.
Quick tip, by the way, people.
That isn't a policy, is it?
It's policy.
It's not a policy, and we appreciate the fact that you've taken the time to lay out your thoughts in a long thing, but if you send us a really long email, we're just going to excerpt bits of it.
Well, they'll get read, or they just won't get read out. In their totality.
All the mails get read.
Being completely honest, though, it's better to send your long thoughts to the...
to the forums.
Long thoughts. To the forums. Send us short emails, because well, then we can
can't
skip
read many words together.
Yeah. And try to not use big words.
And joined up writing doesn't work.
Like marmalade.
Can I carry on now? Right, Brad Phipps says, long time listener. He has two things to say. He says, first off, he always generally considers himself very ACK-like. He's not ashamed to admit it. Poor and son. Usually he agrees with the ginger one.
Oh,
however,
dear. I'm about to get some kind of kicking
he
here.
Says,
I'm really coming.
Well, the word however is a signifier. I have to disagree with him this time. Linux is about the freedom to choose.
Yes.
If Inspire want to stick a licensed DVD player and licensed MP3 decoder in their click and run, then good for them. And if Eric Raymond thinks Ubuntu should have an icon on it in the default install, hey, I won't argue against that either. Now, I won't buy it, but I do think it's a good thing for the Linux community to have it available so that people like my dad can move to Linux. Hang on. Wait for the boot.
Here it comes.
I know he'll hate this comparison, but I think ACK sounds a lot like Theodorot from OpenBSD.
Nice!
I think that guys like Theo and ACK are right, in quotes, but sometimes you just have to get over it.
Yeah!
Stop fucking whining!
So that's his first point.
So his argument is broadly, you should have the freedom to remove other people's freedom. You should have the right to remove other people's rights.
Something like that. His second topic is less important, he says. But I wanted to fill you guys in on some geography.
Does anyone give a shit about his opinion? No, he's compared me to Theodorot.
lucky you.
A few episodes back, you guys talked about the possibilities for Lug Radio Live USA and mentioned the big Ohio Linux Fest in Columbus, Ohio.
Well, sorry.
I grew up in Columbus, and so I have the personal experience. He says, all four of you guys proved your geographic retardedness by seemingly not knowing where any US states were. Yeah, we don't know anything about a foreign country. Why do we care?
Where's Gloucestershire?
Yeah, where's Tipton?
Yeah. All right,
you know where Tipton is.
He says, basically,
I don't want to know. World's biggest scrapyard.
Says, it's sort of like Wolverhampton, I guess. You're probably thinking now is about the time when I'll say, oh, I wish you would have a Luggerated Live USA here. But I'm not going to do that because I understand the reality of your situation. And by God, I'm not going to offer to buy your plane tickets or hotel rooms.
Tight American bastard.
Yeah, well, fuck you too.
He says, anyway.
That's a shame, to be honest with you, because I was looking forward to stabbing him in the bollocks when I met him.
With a freedom knife.
He says, just to finish off, he says, anyway, thanks for the great show. I always look forward to it every fortnight, whatever the fuck a fortnight is.
Thanks.
It's English. It's the language as you speak.
What a great email, eh?
That's good.
Loads of great points.
He lays it out in true email fashion, so well done.
We do like your honesty.
Point typing and sending it by SMTP.
I don't know what... That sentence sort of tailed off towards the end, I think. I was trying to say something complimentary.
That's something that Jono would say.
I know.
But far more sincerely.
We're off the foot. Or on the foot, or whatever.
Why don't you shut up now?
/ get involved.
Okay. Right, I'm going to read a very quick one out here from Christopher Dong.
does that go along with John Thomas?
Well, it's Christopher Dongs.
Does he?
I'm assuming that's how it's pronounced. D-O-N-G-E-S. I'm assuming it's not Donges.
Donge. Why are you assuming it's not Donges?
Because that'd be stupid. That's why.
Oh, yeah, but Dongs isn't.
Not my name.
Being named after more than one penis is perfectly reasonable.
A multitude of penises.
P and I.
His subject is Winky Smile. Thanks for that, you bastard. He just says, love the show, guys, Winky Smile. That was really short.
So he doesn't love the show. He's
that's the whole email. That's
it. Well, don't shoo the guy. I mean, he loves the show.
To be honest with you, we did say, please send us shorter emails.
I mean, what more do you want from an email? A guy with a ridiculous name saying he loves the show.
And he's like the platonic form of a Lug Radio. Radio email contributor, isn't he?
We've had because that's so short, I'm going to move into another one. We've had an email from Nick Protokowatsuix, saying the GNOME Project desktop time waster.
Now this is your idea, wasn't it, that you came up with a few.
Yeah, and likewise, again. I predict a kicking. Hello, Lugradians. Good job on the show. I enjoyed it, even if the focus within the wild world of Linux is a bit narrow for my individual taste. Recently went back and listened to Season 4, Episode 1, since I'd missed it originally. In the segment about what would you do with Google Summer of Code projects, Jono, king of everything, suggested something about...
Does it actually say that?
Yes.
Does it actually say that?
No. Jono suggested something about the GNOME Project desktop, where a user could have partitions in each of his applications and switch between, for example, work, email, IM, contacts, bookmarks, etc. Maybe I'm missing something, but this seems to me to be the most ridiculously over-engineered instance of not invented here I've heard so far.
Yep. So not Prime Minister of Great Britain, leader of the free world for you, then.
That sentence there, that's going to be on my gravestone.
Can you just repeat that?
If you insist, maybe I'm missing something, but this seems to me to be the most ridiculously over-engineered instance of not invented here I've heard so far. This functionality exists already. You can do it within three mouse clicks. Log out, click on a different user, and log in. Right, you're full of shit. That is not a solution. That's rubbish. Separate contacts.
No, it is a solution, isn't it?
It's
not a solution you like.
It's a solution. It's not a solution.
I think it's perfectly reasonable that I should have to set up my email client completely separately and type in all my account details again for every project that I do.
Yeah, that's a really great idea.
Bad.
Yeah.
I'm telling with Jono on this.
Evidently, if Nick does this, and that's the reason why he hasn't got a job and is sending us emails. I'm only joking.
Just put the boot into the
phone. I'm only joking. Anyway,
he said, called two of them dongs.
he says, and I don't buy any objections about how this is too heavyweight or takes too long. Even on my P3 450 powerhouse workstation. It only takes a few seconds. Anyway, developers could developers with much less work than the solution above implement something like OS X's fast user switching. So he's basically saying fast user switching is the way forward, not the concept.
Set up a separate user per project.
He says, my point being, I don't see anything that the GNOME desktop project will give you that that don't already have by creating a couple of different project-specific users.
Now, is that in the same way that you know, a text editor doesn't give you anything more than OpenOffice Writer because you can put all the LaTeX stuff in?
Hey, I mean, the problem here is that even if you had two separate accounts, you'd need entirely different IM accounts. So you'd have to have IM accounts for that specific project, and you'd have to have a separate email address for that particular project. That doesn't work. Anyway, he says, regards Nick Protokowicz, I think it's pronounced. Oh.
I doubt it.
Oh, he says Protokowicz. That's how it's pronounced. He's got it in brackets.
He's giving you a pronunciation guide.
Do you know where he's from? Superior, Wisconsin.
As opposed to shitty Wisconsin, which is where everyone else from Wisconsin is from.
I think you need to move to wrong Kentucky.
No, sorry. Everyone else doesn't live in Superior. They live in Cheesehead, don't they?
Anyway.
Next email.
joke for the Wisconsinites.
Jesus.
Yeah, we got a couple of other emails. I mean, I don't want to go on too much about people saying about the non-free stuff. This chap says broadly the same as the other one who agreed with me. So thank you very much. Although, misapprehensions, I suppose. He says, if more people switch to free software without understanding why they can't play their MP3s or WMVs, then they aren't going to help the FOSS community in any way. They aren't going to force the music labels to release non-DRM music or force the government to stand against patents because they still don't know any better. So the argument there is you convince people by making the ethical argument to them, convincing them that freedom's the way forward. Now, I'm all for that, but it's not working all that well.
Yeah,
which is the big hole in my argument. People aren't all. Everyone who's capable of being convinced by the ethical argument broadly already is convinced. They're already using Linux, and they're people like Benjamin Mako Hill, who's happy to say I'm prepared to do without some functionality in order to have freedom. And to some extent, I am, but a lot of people aren't.
And that's the thing. It's crossing that cavern in between the two viewpoints.
And no matter how much you bang on about freedom, Stallman's been banging on about freedom for 20 years. And he hasn't got all, I mean, on the one hand, he's got quite a long way with it. On the other hand, he hasn't convinced a lot of people.
He's still got
a long way to go, and I'm not sure that his method of convincing is going to work.
And just one other thing, for us moderate left people, if that's the kind of the position, the important thing as well is if somebody's kind of moderate left, then they still believe in the freedom, but believe that that cavern's ultimately unconquerable, and therefore you've got to kind of edge towards it. And I think that's kind of the difference in viewpoint.
Yeah, no,
I think your viewpoint's perfectly valid, but it depends. You view that you can jump over that cavern, whereas the moderate people believe that you can't jump over that cavern, so you've got to kind of move forward a little
bit. And then you have the person who sent us an email under the name Gert Numero Uno, who's contacted us before, and says, have a non-profit organisation tax the proprietary codec purchases to fund the development of open source alternatives.
What?
He was writing with his mad pen that day.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, this non-profit organisation just sets up and sends off an email to Apple and say, you have to pay us some tax now because you invented a thing.
Reading between the lines, I think what it's saying is that...
I mean, do you really believe this is in any way possible?
Incidentally, Jono, you owe me some money. It's a tax on having a beard.
Yeah, there's going to be a new tax where everybody's basically got to pay the Jono tax.
Oh, shit. We have to pay so much.
I'll be paying mine to Jono Coleman.
Sorry, Matt, reading between the lines, you...
I think he means... for people using proprietary codecs on Linux, but still, how are you going to enforce it?
Presumably his idea is that this non-profit organisation gets the proprietary codecs for a certain amount of money, licenses the proprietary codecs for a certain amount of money from the manufacturers.
I think we're
and
reading
then sells
too much
them
into
on
it.
To Linux users.
No, I think what he's saying is that you take proprietary codecs, you pay the license fees to the codec people, and then you sell them on as a product, and obviously you add your markup. Like
well, you don't, because he says non-profit organisation.
Oh, okay then.
So
I think
so
what
you,
he's
you're
saying.
You're just a middleman.
I think what he's saying is bitty bitty bitty.
Pencils.
Are we done?
No, I've got one more letter, and it's from Jacob Lassie. And I was going to say, in answer to his email,
sound like Mango Lassie.
Just freaking Google it. However, anyway, I'll read you his email. I've been trying for ages to find an ISO download for Red Hat Linux, but I can't find one anywhere. Please can tell me where I can go to find a copy. So I was going to say, just freaking Google it. But then I realised he's writing from a Windows Live Mail account, so he genuinely might not know. Right. So get over to Red Hat.
Yep.
You can, if you want to download Fedora, or maybe you get over to CentOS.org.
FedoraProject.org would be the best place to go, I'd have thought, for Fedora.
You could always try Ubuntu.com.
Fedora.redhat.com. Mm-hmm. Yeah, is where to go for Fedora. Or to go to CentOS.org if you want the freely distributable version.
Yeah, distro.
Please don't use CentOS if you want it for desktop.
Another fairly serious point here is, if you want answers to that kind of questions, you're a lot better to go to forums.lugradio.org and ask there, because there the whole Lug Radio community will help you.
The only reason I gave him some leeway is because he's a Windows Live Mail user.
No, absolutely.
So we always encourage new people.
It looks like he's looking to make the shift, and
Good man.
We applaud you for that. So I go to forums.lugradio.org, post your question there, and people will be able to help you in more detail than you could possibly ever want.
Well, the music's playing. The end of the show is near.
Oh, hark, I hear it.
And
the end of the award-winning really
the award-winning Lug Radio.
The award-winning Lug Radio.
Wow. The drums are so involved and complex.
Yeah, that's going to be re-recorded.
Just like the Archer's thing.
Great show, and we'll see you guys soon.
Ta-da!
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.